Okay, welcome to episode 19 of the Never Iron Anything podcast. This podcast has been created to keep you occupied during the virus lockdown, which is almost, well, I'm fingers crossed, a couple more weeks. My name is Tony Esmond, writer of the Monster Spots Club and Atomic Hercules, and one of the hosts of the Awesome Comics podcast, where I say more rude words than I say on this one. Today we have a comics fan who not only runs a super popular comics festival, he also runs a comic-centric podcast with a certain co-collaborator of mine. But he's also busy, and really busy at the moment, creating his own content, his own comics. Yes, folks, it's Stuart Mulrain. Hello, Stuart.
Hello. Fucking hell, you sure that's me?
Yes, it's you. That's quite an intro, isn't it? You like that? Yeah.
I think you bigged me up too much.
Yeah, it's only downhill now, my friend.
I know, we're going to have to layer in the inevitable disappointment.
My sexual technique in a sentence. So the aim of this episode is to give you some insight into a particular comics miniseries that, in my opinion, changed the world's biggest comics character forever. Stu, would you like to tell us what listeners, which you have chosen to talk about? What have you chosen?
I have chosen the Superman, the Man of Steel, the John Byrne post-crisis reboot of
Excellent.
The Superman mythos.
Brilliant. So that is, I'm right in saying, is it six-issue miniseries?
It is, yeah.
Yep, six-issue miniseries came out between July and September 1986, bi-weekly, believe it or not. It's written and penciled by John Byrne, not the John Burns who did, what were you talking about a minute ago?
George and Lynn.
Not the George and Lynn character we spoke about in a previous episode. This is the British-born but moved to America John Byrne of Uncanny X-Men fame. It's inked by Dick Giordano, who we will talk about in a minute as well. Very interesting character. Letters by John Costanza. Colours by Tom Zinko, edited by Andy Helfer. It is essentially the modern origin, isn't it? I think it's a good description of it.
It's, yeah, a reboot.
Yeah.
Before reboots were a thing.
Before we called them a reboot, I suppose, didn't it, really? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
A retelling of the mythos and, rebuilding the canon.
Yeah, a change. There's a change at work here, which I'm sure we'll talk about as we go along. But there's a certain change. I think can be summed up by a quote I read from or heard from Byrne say today. I have taken my standard back to basics approach, he says. Okay. Yep. All right, Johnny. I've got some strong opinions about this, which we're going to get into as we go along. But to start with, Mr. M, I'm going to say, so now I've known you for, what, 5 or 6 years now, I suppose, something like that?
Yeah, since like second or third Troops, I think.
Yeah, okay. Troops being the True Believers Comic Festival that you are.
I assume we're not talking about that.
No,
Furry's dog in session, we were both at.
No, we're not talking about that. Well, yeah, no. We never talk about that, do we? We barely even make eye contact these days.
Well, no, not after that time.
Yeah. But I kind of associate you with Superman. I kind of see you as that Superman fan. So why is he's your favourite character, I'm right in saying that, is it?
He is. I mean, he's the reason I got into comics.
Whenabouts was that? So what was the era for that?
For me, when I really properly got into comics, because I honestly can't remember if I was a kid when I first discovered Superman, but I can't remember whether it was the Chris Reeve films first, or I'd picked up a UK reprint of the second issue of Man of Steel.
Oh, right. So it was in the 80s you got into Superman.
Yeah, it was about 88, I think it was published. But yeah, it was the London Edition magazine's reprint.
Right, okay.
So it had, like, apart from the first 7 pages, all of issue 2 in it. So from him dealing with the hostage situation onwards to the interview with Lois Lane, that sort of thing.
Okay, so fairly classic Reeves material as well there, isn't there?
Yeah.
We'll get into that in a bit. But so you hadn't experienced Kurt Swan, you hadn't experienced any of that sort of previous Silver Age, Bronze Age madness?
Not at the time, and then I properly got into Superman when he came back from the dead.
Right,
we were on holiday in Menorca, I think it was, and they did write one of those Spanish newspapers for English people.
Right, okay.
And on the back, it had the picture of the foil edition of Superman number 82, the Back for Good cover.
Yeah.
And I was just, something clicked with me, and it's like, oh shit, they brought him, because I knew he died the year before. And I was like, yeah, cool, whatever. And then when they brought him back, I was really interested in how they'd done it. So as soon as we got home from holiday, I made my first trip to a comic shop. And then bought that issue and reread it and was like, I love this, I don't get some of the things. So I went back the following weekend and picked up some of the issues that came before, and then pretty much did a deep dive into that Death to Return of Superman run.
Yep, it's a great run. I really enjoyed that run. Yeah.
Subscribed to the 4 Superman comics that came out, well, it was every week, wasn't it? You had Man of Steel, Action Comics Adventure and Superman.
They call them the Triangles. Is it the Triangle series? Because they had a little triangle, didn't they? With the
which
numbers.
I absolutely loved. And when you're coming into comics at that stage, it was so handy.
Yeah.
For knowing.
For people who don't understand what that is, they had four regular Superman comics. They obviously had Superman in Action, which is Superman became Adventures of Superman, didn't it?
Yeah, Superman became Adventures of Superman and kept the number in. And Superman was rebooted with issue one with John Byrne after the Man of Steel miniseries. Yeah.
And what was the fourth one?
You had Adventures, Action, and Superman, the Man of Steel became an ongoing title. And then they added a fifth one early to mid-90s, which was Superman, Man of Tomorrow, which was done to fill the... Because you get an occasional empty week where no Superman had come out
because
of how the year is full. So I think that was like a quarterly year of a year one. So you got four issues a year.
So because you had a single character and a single storyline to a certain extent running through those titles, what they did is they put a little triangle on the cover and it told you the order to read them in, which is kind of cool. You know, kind of worked out well, I think that.
Yeah, it was really handy. I used to like laying them all out on my bedroom floor. And then as I got too many, the living room floor, much to my parents' annoyance. But yeah, so I got caught up in that. And then obviously there was the Dirt Max Radio stuff and Lois and Clark had just started on TV. So I got caught in a perfect storm of Superman.
Right, Superman was everywhere. So this was well post Superman 4.
Yes.
And so I remember going to a UCAC and them showing the advert for the Superman and Lois, Clark and Lois TV series, and it didn't have him in costume, and it had them sort of just cuddling.
Yeah, it was black and white with them.
That's right.
The tattoo with the Superman logo was the only thing in colour on.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I remember.
And I remember everyone laughing. As like, the DC, the geezer had come and shown it. It was like, no, it's all right, it's all right. And we were sort of laughing on it, you know. But it turned out okay for a couple of seasons, didn't it? You know.
I mean, the first series in particular is very... Because it took that Burn mythos as its jumping off point.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously did its own thing with it, but was pretty true to it with their own spin kind of thing. And it's probably the closest we'll ever get to a live action version of Burn Superman.
Yeah, I think you're right. And we'll get to the Dirk Max stuff as well.
It was very much aimed at the moonlighting crowd. Yeah. It was that sort of tone.
And like,
I was
like
the perfect age for it to have an effect on me. It's the show that made me want to be a writer.
Right, okay. And the light moonlighting, it was when it, as soon as they actually got together, it kind of went a bit shit, didn't it?
Yeah, and it says that once they sort of changed the creative team behind it at the end of the first series, the second series is all right, and then it really just goes off the rails.
Yeah.
But kind of in that way that comics did for a period in the Silver Age.
Okay, right.
So it's kind of got that kooky Silver Age feel about it.
So let's rewind a little bit to this to the series and just before it. So Pete came on and we talked about whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow, which was kind of the lid was put on the coffin of Silver Age and Bronze Age Superman and buried. And we lost. Byrne's been quite open about saying we lost all the sort of varieties of kryptonite. We lost the fact that Superman could push the Earth out of orbit or travel backwards in time or whatever madness was going on, which I have to admit I kind of like, man, you know. And he reset it. So we got Man of Steel 1, which came out, is it a couple of months after whatever happened to Man of Steel? I think there was a time break, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was a period where there was nothing for a while, wasn't there?
Yeah, okay. It opens on... a prologue, which is basically the origin story, and we'll talk a bit about the time jumps it takes between issues as well. But it opens on Krypton, and in that sort of strange alien costumey, we saw it in 2112, and you know, Byrne was quite well known for these sort of bizarre. It was a little bit Shi'ar, Magistrix kind of X-Men thing. The costumes to me, a lot of heavy inks. So he redesigned the clothing and the architecture and the ships and everything of Krypton, didn't he?
Yes. Yeah, gave it a very 80s sort of, but also kind of timeless.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's very Byrne. And then we time jump to Smallville, and that's when you really begin to notice not only the visual changes, but the story changes. So Clark is playing in the American football team for the school and doing really well, as opposed to previously where he sort of kind of faked the fact he was a bit shit at football and stuff like that. He's suddenly this sort of amazing football player and a sort of the jock of the team, isn't he?
Yeah, and his dad sort of picks him up and guilts him a little bit into...
Yeah.
Because he's like, Clark knows that he can do things.
Yeah.
And he doesn't know why, but he knows that he's got abilities.
Yeah, and Lana's kind of a little bit proto... Baby Hit Me One More Time, Britney Spears, look, isn't she? There's some jailbag bunches going on, I'm saying there. Yeah. And then Parkent says, look, we need to go. I need to show you something. And he takes you to this rocket ship, which is, to me, harks back a little bit to the Golden Age. And we'll talk a bit about this, because Byrne takes him back to the Golden Age in this, doesn't he? There's, when you think about Superman, when he began, he was you know, a lot less powerful than he was in the Silver and the Bronze Age. And Byrne does that a bit here, doesn't he? And the spaceship is reminiscent of those early designs a little bit for me. What do you think?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's sort of that classic. Again, it's a classic with a current sort of feel for the time, I think. But yeah, I think it's very respectful of what has come before. That's the whole thing about this reboot, is that it's very respectful to what has come before. It doesn't really, I mean, apart from streamlining it, it doesn't take much away from the mythos.
Okay.
And it doesn't add too much to it for me that it's something completely different.
Yeah, okay.
And even Byrne's art is very, at times, respectful of Kurt Swan. There's very Kurt Swan-ish-esque elements to some of it on Superman for me. Right. I mean, Byrne...
It's very bright, it's very light. You know, in the era of 1986, when everything was becoming grim and gritty, there is a lightness to it, isn't there, which is... quite right too for a Superman comic, you know.
It's that, yeah, it's that nice bridge between the Kurt Swan era and then what would come with Dan Jurgens and Brett Breeden and all that lot doing
Yeah, exactly. Jurgens is a continuation of this for me. I think there's quite a few artists who come in the wake of this that, and they use throughout the miniseries, for those who haven't seen them, they use there's a themed design almost to the covers, isn't there? There's a recognizable design going through it.
It basically hits, well, out of the six issues, I'd say four key moments for Superman.
Right, okay.
With, you know, in the early years.
Yeah.
For me, and then a couple that I get why he did it, but at the same time, possibly other things he could have looked at. The Bizarro issue, for example.
Which is, in its name, completely fucking bizarre, and we'll get onto that in a minute. Something going on there I don't understand. So the first time, those don't know, the first issue is 32 pages, so it gets an extra long one. So, and it's done in prologue and done in chapter, so we get the prologue, which is Krypton, we get chapter one, which is the secret, which is the revelation of the spaceship. Clark suddenly feels weak, and you get a little bit of kitschy dialogue in it, I have to say.
The dialogue's very comic booky.
Yeah, it is.
It possibly wouldn't fly now, but for the time, it's very... It's not quite, again, that gold and silver age, quite on-the-nose dialogue, but there's still that element to it, especially in places. Some of it's, as a writer, would be clunky shit. How they keep, like, you know, I've thought our paths have crossed since you first popped onto the scene 17 months ago. Like, really clunky fucking...
I think I sent you the first panel, didn't I, the other day?
Yeah, the Krypton dialogue.
Oh, my God. What is going on there? So this is panel two.
Are just uptight.
Yeah. Welcome home, my lord. I trust your journey was a successful one. Okay, that's a robot saying that. That's fine. I understand that. Okay, cool. It was. And it was not, Kellex. I have listened. What there is to learn, I only wish I had not. Where is the... What the fuck does that mean? I don't know what that means. So, Andy, come on,
I
help.
I think
he's
going for the alien approach to Krypton.
Yeah, and a sort of slightly haughty kind of feel to him, isn't there, you know? Slightly officious.
Yeah.
Kind of, yeah, Jor-El.
There's something cold about it, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. Yeah. So the other thing is, Mar and Park Kent, they like scrapbooking. That's another thing they like doing. I discovered that about them. And they're drawn very sort of cuddly, aren't they? They're very sort of...
They're very all-American.
Yeah, picket fencey kind of people, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you discover that Superman has sort of flown in from Metropolis. He saved this sort of experimental plane, which has got Lois in it.
Yeah.
And he's a bit overwhelmed, isn't he? He's a bit overwhelmed with his role.
Yeah, it's... I love this. I love this whole idea of everybody wanting a piece of him as soon as he touches down after he saved the plane, which
isn't it? You know.
I think it's a better way of dealing with how the world would react to somebody like Superman than has been done in, say, for example, Man of Steel.
Right.
Where it's like, well, you'd instantly fear him. It's like, I don't think you would. You'd instantly want things from him.
Yeah, yeah. He's
basic a celebrity human nature.
He would be a celebrity, wouldn't he? And so he returns home, and there's a slight darkness in that scene, and there's a slight moment in that scene where you think, oh, he's a bit depressed, what's going on there? Which is very un-Superman-like, but is understandable as part of the narrative to me. And so chapter four, or the epilogue, is The Superhero. So we find out that Ma is making him a Superman costume. There's no sort of kitschy, confused element of why the S is that way. It just sort of goes with it, doesn't it?
See, I love that. I've never liked the whole on Krypton, it was the symbol for hope.
Yeah.
I've always found that just really insulting to the reader. So on the fucking nose.
Yeah.
The whole idea is, I love the idea that, you know, he must have a background in graphic design, but that his mum made the suit for him and him and his dad came up with the symbol.
Yeah. Have you tried drawing that S? I'm sure you have. It ain't easy.
I draw it on the top of my timesheet at work so it stands out. Right, so I do it at least once a week.
Right, okay. Yeah, it's not an easy S to draw, is it? It's not an easy design.
I'm not saying I do it well. But yeah, I just love that whole thing. I like that it becomes a symbol of hope because of what Superman is, rather than he wears it because it's the symbol of hope from his home.
I found that a bit...
I find that it being the symbol of hope kind of takes away his decision to be a symbol of hope.
Yeah, as a kid when I read these comics, I knew that it was Superman because it was an S. It's fairly fucking obvious.
Yeah.
It's an S because he is Superman. Don't try and make it some kind of weird coincidence with something else. It's just an S because he's Superman. I'm fine with that. That does me. As a kid, my little brain used to work it out that way, and I think that's fine. The only thing I will say
about otherwise everybody's going to be like, well, it's got to be, we've got to come to something with an S now.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, what can
it's,
we call
it's
it?
That whole dialogue from the Man of Steel of on my planet it means hope.
Yeah, I'll fuck off. Yeah.
And that thing that went round about I am Hope Man, bitch.
Now, towards the end here, I find it a little bit weird. So, Ma and Pa Kent, these sort of cuddly old couple, who I suspect probably are doggers in some way or other, then watch their adoptive son get dressed and make little comments on him, on his muscles and stuff, and on his boots and stuff like that. It's a little bit creepy, I'll be honest with you. It's a little bit weird. Did your parents ever watch you, or, you know, as a 25-year-old man, did they ever watch you get dressed? I don't think they ever did.
I can't say I ever got dressed in front of them as a 25-year-old man. But
yeah.
I mean, I had superpowers and was putting a costume on for the first time.
Yeah, different scenario, you never know. If they designed you a Superman costume, you're about to fly out the window. And then we get a very cheesy, but in role, in mood, in tone moment where he says it'll be a job for Superman and he flies out.
I love the original art of that. That and then the first page of the story of the century with him flying past the window behind Lois Lane.
Yes, that's my other favourite. We'll get
on
to that.
If there were two bits of John Byrne art that I could own, it'd be those two.
That's a superb page. We'll get onto that in a second, definitely. So that's the first issue, slightly longer. Does what we all don't look for in movies or in comics these days, because we all kind of know the Superman origin, but back then, maybe in 86, there was a lot of kids who didn't, because he'd been about fighting, you know, green rabbits and magicians and, you know, being turned into
it gives you, without overly dwelling on it, it gives you everything you need.
Right.
How he gets away from Krypton. You don't have the whole Jor-El arc, the inner war on Krypton and people not believing Jor-El and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
It leaves it enough that if people want to go back to it, which I think Byrne did with like the World of Krypton, the World of Smallville, the World of Metropolis miniseries that he did.
Yep.
So he's given himself enough space to go back and maybe re-edit and add things in that he possibly... It gave him enough breathing space
to build
the world.
It's definitely a rush. It's a rush through this, isn't it? Yeah. The origin, it really is. And the whole miniseries in it. To a certain extent, he's trying to get decades of Superman history into one sort of short series, isn't he?
I was going to say, if that was my one major issue with it, is that I don't like how much time it passes within the six issues. I would have quite liked it to be a nice, tight, year-long, you know, the first year of Superman with the obvious flashbacks.
Yeah. Cool.
Because I think it covers about 8 years.
Yeah. Now, issue two is the lowest issue, isn't it? It's the kind of design. She's done very well for me by Byrne. So I really get the lowest character in this. Yeah.
Well, that's because he had all that practice doing George and Lynn.
when he's on George and Lynn, it's fine. But she's I mean, he says this himself. He loves creating strong females, and you know, from Jean Grey to She-Hulk. I know they're all slightly sexy, but they do have great, you know, interesting, funny, strong personalities, you know, and they will kick you in the face or perhaps eat your world, you know, sort of thing. This one about Lois Lane.
And flawed in a way that isn't a man being like silly woman.
Yeah.
Kind of flaws.
Exactly. Yeah.
They feel like real flaws kind of thing.
Yeah. And as you say, the splash page of that, the story of the century, book two, it's described as, is Superman flying sideways past the back of a window as Lois is sitting opposite Perry, talking to him in a what looks like a diner. And so beautiful. Though my favourite panel from this book is that one, I think, genuinely. Yeah.
Really, oh, it's good. Gorgeous.
Yep.
But like you say, Lois is drawn spot on. It's framed wonderfully.
Yeah, it is. Beautifully framed, isn't it?
Yep. And again, it takes you straight into what the story is going to be.
Yep.
Without you realising it.
I've seen some YouTube videos and stuff about this where they say, oh, Luther didn't come in till, is it issue four or something? And I'm thinking, no, he was in issue two, clearly. He's the guy in the limo, isn't he, that she blows off? Yeah.
Yeah, because that's the other way they show the passing of time, is his hair recedes.
That's right. Yeah.
He's an omnipresence in it. Yep. Early on, he's talked about, and like you say, you see him in silhouette and you see his eyes peering through the back of the window when Lois rejects him.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so he's in there. Should we talk a little bit about Byrne? Let's have a little chat about him. So,
yep.
John Lindley Byrne, born July 6, 1950. Do you know where he was born?
It was in this country, but I can't remember where.
Walsall in Staffordshire. Yeah, believe it or not. Co-created loads of Marvel characters, probably most famous for his Marvel run, but jumped between companies and backwards and forwards between Marvel and DC for a few years and did some amazing, amazing work.
He created a lot of Alpha Flight, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Yep. He created Kitty Pryde, Emma Frost, Sabretooth, many more. Was a big fan of George Reeves' Adventures of Superman, which I've watched a few of and actually stand up quite well. I actually quite enjoy watching them.
Yeah, that's how he discovered Superman.
Yeah,
it's the introduction to this book. He talks about Superman for him is this. Because in that Modern Masters Volume 7, the one that's focused on him, he says that he pretty much got the job on Superman by going around town shooting his mouth off to everybody that'd listen, saying that, see, they got it right in the Christopher Reeve movie. Why can't DC get it right?
Okay.
And he was like, according to him, it was years of him going around shooting his mouth off that DC don't know how to do Superman right.
Right.
And in the end, I think they were like, just do it then, man.
Yeah. I think he'd actually left Marvel and then was approached by Marv Wolfman to work on it and got chatting to him about it. I'm not going to get into the John Byrne, you know, crazy stories because I like him. He's famously a difficult man to get on with. But then again, so are you and I. Do you know what I mean? He saw a Superboy, Johnny Quick and Batman in a UK annual, which if you watch the, is it Sci-Fi Wire, I think it's called on YouTube, he shows the interview of this annual, and it's an old British annual, and apparently it reprints some black and white Australian strips that were originally American, but then black and white for the Australian market, then sold in Britain. I think it's one of those sort of things. In 1962, he saw Fantastic Four number 5, which he said really inspired him. He went to the Alberta because he, after being born in England, he left. I think he was about aged eight or something like that. Moved to Canada.
Yeah, it was about eight. They moved to Canada, didn't they?
Yeah. Went to the Alberta College of Art and Design, and he created a comic there. Do you know the name of that comic?
I don't.
It was a comic called Different Times, Gay Guy. And
that wouldn't fly now.
not an Esmond comic, my friend. And. He was it was designed to take the piss out of art students at his university, and it was apparently quite funny. He left without graduating, and he did a fan art piece in Foom in 1974. Then he got a job at, as a lot of these guys start at Charlton. Charlton Comics seem to be, we've talked about quite a few guys now who started at Charlton Comics, and he worked on...
Charlton had a huge influence on comics, though, down to lettering. I watched a YouTube video about lettering, weirdly enough.
Okay.
And the Charlton way became the standard.
Right.
From what they were saying, again, it's a YouTube video, so, but from what they were saying on that, and it kind of tracks if you now look at lettering.
Yeah.
All the things had a different way, and the Charlton way generally became the considered way of doing it.
Okay. He did a comic called Rog 2000, which was based on Roger Stern, who later became his editor on a couple of books as well, and was a guy who got him in at Marvel, I think. Pat Broderick had defaulted on a deadline for Iron Fist. And he ended up working on an Iron Fist story, was kind of his big story. He's Kieran Dwyer, well, he used to be Kieran Dwyer's stepfather, believe it or not.
Yeah.
He's also a comic book artist. He's a great comic book artist. He is apparently, now I've read this on two websites, now whether they both got them from the same source and it's not true, I don't know. But apparently he's colourblind. Had you read that?
I hadn't read, actually no, I think I had read that somewhere, but
yeah.
I couldn't tell you. Again, I did it. There's not a lot on John Byrne. Well, there is, but there's also not. He's very standoffish. A lot of things on John Byrne tend to generally degrade down into the, he's a bit of a prick there.
He can be. I know. I read this interview with Gail Simone, which she clearly had like real, oh, they'd argued, you know, and she was sort of trying her best not to give it away, but said, oh, you know, he can be quite difficult. You know, it's like one of those sort of things.
Yeah.
It's Gail trying to be polite, you know.
Well, it comes across in that SoFi Wire video that you sent me the link to that I'd watched a little while ago.
Yeah.
It just is very much like, fine, I would do this because I clearly have to do it, but the sooner you get the fuck out of my studio.
Oh, in one of the interviews, he says, oh, well, thank you, now get out. And he says it half as a joke. But I kind of, when I watched it, I thought, he fucking means that. Come on, you guys think he means that. He cites Neil Adams, Steve Ditko, and Jack Kirby as his influences in American comics. He's actually got some original pages from all those artists, if you look on his walls. But he's also a fan of Giles, which I found interesting. Frank Bellamy and Frank Hampson, he quotes as well in a video I watched of him, which is quite interesting. He's got two pages of Superman versus Spider-Man, which is brilliant. He's got some Dick Sprang pages. He's a huge Batman fan, which we'll talk about in a minute, I think. And he has got in his studio a really weird, looks like a sex doll, life-size doll of Gal Gadot, Wonder Woman statue. I'm sure it's not a sex doll for anyone who wants to take legal action, but it did kind of look a little bit like one. You know, late at night, I might, you know what I mean?
You've had a couple.
He's asked in that interview what his favourite book is, and he says OMAC. Which is that's a deep cut for Burn.
Yeah.
And I kind of like it. Now, OMAC, I think, off the top of my head, years since I've read it, I've got it here, is black and white, isn't it? I think.
It's if a black I remember and white rightly, book. Yeah, again, I... Yeah, I'm sure it was.
Yeah.
Because I know they brought it back, didn't they, as during one of the final crises or something like that, but...
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm trying to think back now. Yeah, I'm sure it was black and white.
Yeah, I think it is, yeah. So, that's Mr. Byrne. I am a huge fan of John Byrne's work. Absolutely huge. He was the first sort of superstar artist that I sort of glommed onto. He I've bought nearly everything he's done. I've not enjoyed everything he's done, but I've certainly bought it. I'm the owner of an original Byrne page that I bought 2 years ago in New York.
I remember you sending me a picture when you bought it.
Yeah, it was just after I took a picture of me with who's the artist you like. I bought that book for you from him.
Terry Moore.
Yes, just after that, wasn't it? So, in fact, they were next door to each other. Their tables were next door to each other. Yeah.
Nice.
Okay. And I have to say, I find some of his work really amazing. I think some of his favourite stuff is with Austin, Terry Austin, when he's certainly X-Men was like, you know, heaven for me. And still is a book that I will read yearly. This is slightly looser. He's inked by Dick Giordano on this book. And we'll talk about Dick in a minute because he's an extremely interesting character. So we get into we're on to issue two, which is back to another 22-page issue. So it's back to that normal length. We get Lois blowing him off. No, not like that. Lois blowing off Luther and chasing the Superman story instead. There's a classic Christopher Reeve moment where he stops a robbery.
I was about to say, I absolutely love this bit. And then
do you want to describe that bit?
So he basically, this woman with a boombox has her purse nicked by a mugger. And he's looking back as he runs and you just see Superman's feet and his silhouette on the wall behind.
Yeah,
and then the S and the guy runs into his chest.
That's it.
And then tries to turn to run the other way and Superman's there as well.
Yeah.
And then he tracks down the woman, gives her back her purse, hears about armed robbery on her boombox, slams the guy in a garbage can for, you know, using the Americanism, hangs him from a lamppost, and then just before he flies off, he turns the volume down on her boombox.
Yeah.
Says, in a city this size, consideration for others is... It's what makes life bearable, and then just flies off with a bye now, and I absolutely love that.
And classic 1980s female punk as well. It really reminded me of that moment in, is it Star Trek 4, where they...
I want the bus.
That bit, where he tells him to turn the music down. God damn, turn the music down. And then he goes off to stop a robbery, and it is, I've never seen, so I mean, you see robbery teams, what a shit robbery team. There's a fat bloke, a skinny bloke, and a lady, and that's it. Yeah. That's their, you know, if I walked, if they said, hand over the money, I'd go, nah, sorry. You're not going to be able to run away, let's face it. You'd be all right. I think I'll leave it, you know.
They have got machine guns, I suppose.
Yeah, they have got machine guns, I suppose. And then one of the shocking bit of that I found out is when Superman takes the woman's glasses off and knocks her out by flicking her, and I thought, that's not very Superman. Surely he could have just tied her up or something, you know. It seems a weird one.
And then we get... You wonder with how much force did he punch the two blokes.
Yeah, exactly. And then we get a sort of montage. It's like a it's like an 80s montage of Lois looking for Superman and trying to find
just missing him all the time.
Yeah. But the thing that always strikes me about this is Byrne goes to town on costumes for Lois in this.
Oh yeah, she's got more costume changes than.
Yeah, she's in high heels or boots, and she's got like one she looks like she's a noir detective. The other looks like it's, you know, sort of, and she still can't get to the story first. She heads in the office and she's got this sort of quite a cool sort of light blue and white outfit on with her feet on the desk, typical Lois. And then she fakes. An accident, doesn't he? She gets attention.
Yeah, she drives the car off the end of the pier.
I thought it was a nice Superman moment, I thought, that bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, really nice. And it turns out that Clark has got to the story right already.
Yeah.
But there's a couple of... It gets a bit sexy. I'm going to say it gets a bit... Cersei, she's got the nicest apartment ever for a news reporter. But he's on the couch with her. Yeah. And she's got... she's sort of in her dressing gown with her hair sort of up in a bun, just having got out of the shower. And Clark's or Superman's on the couch with her, with his hand sort of behind her. You know that move you often use in the cinema with girls, where you sort of yawn and put your arm out. He's sort of doing a bit of that with her, and I thought this gets a bit lively.
It's the whole before, once he's dropped her off at her apartment. I mean, you've got the creepy line where she's like, "You know where I live." He's like, "Of course, Miss Lane, I know where everyone lives." It's like, ew.
Yeah.
But then you got the whole thing where she doesn't know what to say. He's about to fly off, and then she just does that. Come back here. He's like, yes.
Yeah, in the bag, as I would just call it. Yeah. Okay, so that's issue two.
Then he knows that she's faked it because he could see the Aqualung under her car seat.
Yep.
And then he goes for his appointment at the Daily Planet where he hands in the story. And I quite like the thing that, you know, she goes through all that effort and then gets scooped.
Yeah. Yeah.
It sets up the Lois and Clark relationship quite nicely.
Yeah, it does. It really does. Yeah, for the rest of the run, actually. And let's face it, it's kind of the relationship now, in a certain extent.
Yeah.
You know. Okay, so issue three. Now, it has the worst title of any comic ever. One Night in Gotham City. Jesus Christ.
Sounds like a sex tape.
Yeah, get someone else to write your titles for you.
But those nine panels, I absolutely love, that open the
book. That's a great panel. Yeah, it's a great page. Yeah, yeah. So he opens on a nine-panel grid. Which I'm guessing was a Watchmen homage or a little wink of some kind, you know, a little sort of piss take. And it's basically Batman kicking the shit out of someone.
You start on a gargoyle, don't you? And then it moves slightly, and then it's above an alley, and you can see a guy running away from a crying. And then it's just Batman dropping down closer and closer and then beating the shit out of him.
Yep. And it sets the tone for the difference that these two men would have.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah.
Yeah. I love Burns Batman as well.
Do you? That's interesting. Very, you can see the inking heavy on that one, to be fair, I think. It's brought out by the inking on the cloak. It's very, almost Alan Davis-esque, I would say.
Yeah, but I quite like that grey and blue era Batman.
Right.
It's very, that era of Batman.
Yeah, yeah,
There's a couple where he's a bit squiffy, but yeah, for the most part, I really like how he's done him.
Yeah. Now, this is undoubtedly, because Batman is not a huge part of the Superman mythos. He is a part of it, but he isn't enough to be the third issue. You know, the third person they go to, you know, the third theme.
Yeah, this is one, as much as I like it and as good of a Batman and Superman story, I think it is. The villain's a bit weak, but it's not about the villain, it's about them two.
Yeah, yeah.
I think
it's because Byrne liked Batman. I think that's kind of where it sits. He's quite open about loving Batman, about how much he wants to draw him, you know.
Yeah, it's a little bit. I suppose, I don't know, because obviously I didn't come from that era that came before.
Yeah.
It sort of reestablishes that relationship, which I suppose is important given how... Because, I mean, the last line of that is jumping ahead, but it's Batman saying, "A remarkable man, all things considered. Who knows, in a different reality I might have called him a friend."
Okay, so that's a little callback, maybe.
So, and yeah, I think it's kind of a, you know, the world's dynamic finest. Has shifted between having, you know, done years of World's Finest and
It's this super, it's this issue. Yeah. It's this issue. I begin to feel it's parts of it, panels of it are underdrawn. I think there's some panels where we go full on, you know, vertigo, looking down between buildings. There's some lovely stuff, but then you go to the next panel, it's barely anything in the background. I don't know. I began to feel Byrne's work getting a bit looser post Fantastic Four maybe and stuff like that. And I just
I think with some of it he's enjoying drawing some of it so much that he then, you know, I don't want to at the risk of casting dispersions, but it looks like if it's like where the one where Batman says something's got his line, he looks up, the Superman in that's very flatly drawn.
Yeah.
But he's clearly enjoyed drawing Batman in that.
Yeah. There's a few pages that lack a bit of he might have been under a deadline. It was a bi-weekly book after a while.
But I mean, he was drawing them all.
Yeah. Okay. So in this, Batman's got a pink force field. That's
You say right. It like that's not something we've all got.
Yeah, I know a few people have. Yeah,
but it's because it's infrared, isn't it? It's Superman using his infrared vision, so
it is his infra-pink vision, and yeah, he's kind of really. That's kind of how I felt about it. Even when I read it back in the day, I thought, oh, really? What is going on here? You know. Now there's a sort of little subplot which is kind of clever. I'm going to say it's clever and then doesn't work for me. So to stop him being taken into custody by Superman, because Batman is seen by Superman as a vigilante stroke, you know.
Yeah, he's come to Gotham to take him in, hasn't he?
Yeah, he says, there is a bomb planted on a somebody who lives in Gotham, and if I'm arrested, that bomb will go off and kill that person. Okay, so spoilers. Yeah. Now, which is a clever idea. And then, of course, it turns out at the end of the issue that the bomb is actually hidden on Batman.
Yeah.
And he was talking about himself. Now, my problem, and I don't pretend to be one of these people who goes around going, oh, Batman wouldn't do that, or Spider-Man wouldn't do that. My problem is, in my opinion, and I'm going to break my own rules here, I don't think Batman would have told him. He almost shows off about it, doesn't he?
Yeah, but I think that's kind of in the... Because I think... Otherwise, what's to stop Superman just grabbing him and...
Yeah, but then again, Batman's cleverer than Superman in my head. Batman is the you know, the tactician. You know, he's the one... He wouldn't allow him to take him. There must... I don't know, because as soon as he shows his hand about, oh, it's me with the bomb after all, you know that that he's now vulnerable. And Batman
I think
doesn't
by
trust
that point,
anyone
he's
that much.
He's proved himself to Superman.
Yeah, but why should he? He's Batman. And Batman doesn't trust anyone. To be fair, that's why I don't feel it's Batman. It's only my
But then Batman doesn't need to trust
opinion.
Him. I think Batman wants Batman wants Superman to trust him, but he doesn't trust Superman. I don't think he ever trusts Superman.
Yeah, that's true. Anyway, so I found that interesting. It's an interesting little tactic. I think this was the villain of this is a woman called Magpie who's got these her mask is kind of these cool earrings and a sort of big red pair of sunglasses.
And a wig.
Yeah, and a wig, a syrup. Was this her first appearance? Do you know? I'm not sure.
I'm not sure whether she came before. It's obviously her first appearance in this timeline. But
she's very Byrne-esque, isn't she? She reminds me of a couple of characters.
And again, she's got that stuff. 80s punk look thing going on, hasn't she?
Yeah, she really has. Now, she is proven... So Gotham is a whole... I think what they're saying here is Gotham is a different ballgame. Gotham is another playing field. And she does a thing which she says is a happy birthday where she puts dynamite in somebody's gob.
Which is such a Joker move.
Yeah, it really is, isn't it? Yeah. And the Joker appears elsewhere in Byrne's run, doesn't he?
He
comes in later. Yeah. And that's all solved, and Superman does his classic George Reeves crashing through a wall kind of move after the murder. So she kills a guy, and then he comes crashing through the wall. And then there's a moment where Superman sort of breathes in the gas, so he's out of the way, but Batman's got a mini lab in the boot of his bloody Batmobile. Portable crime lab, he calls it. And I'm like, really? What? How many Batmobiles do you lose, my friend?
As a kid, though, I bought that.
Yeah, no,
but then
I'd
come off the Adam West TV series as well, so it's kind of like, of course he has.
Yeah. And in that page where you see the revelation of the crime thing, which looks like a load of cash point machines attached to the car, the very Dick Giordano there, the Batman in the second panel, really reminds me of perhaps a more sort of classic era. Maybe a sort of Ross Andrew kind of Batman, even veering towards the Neil Adams kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, even down to the car, it's very much treading that line between the Silver Age and the Modern Age.
Yeah.
Or the Bronze Age, maybe, more than the Silver Age, rather.
Yeah, definitely. Let's mention Dick here, because mention Dick Giordano here. He was I'm a fan of his stuff. I really do like his stuff, and I think as an inker, he was certainly one of the world's best. But 1932 to 2010, he lived. He was the mentor for Bob Layton and Terry Austin. So Terry Austin is certainly associated with Byrne big time. Born in New York City, attended the School of Industrial Art. Began as a freelance artist at, can you guess, Charlton Comics, 1952. Worked on Annie Oakley, Billy the Kid, and Fighting Army. He worked on Strange Suspense Stories, and which is a comic that got some panels of which got nicked by Roy Lichtenstein.
Yes.
Controversially stolen and, you know, sold for millions.
And made as art.
Yes, exactly.
Because it wasn't art before.
Yes, exactly. Rose to executive editor at Charlton and gave artists and writers such as Jim Aparo, Denny O'Neill and Steve Skeets a start in a business. Erwin Donenfield, who was DC Comics vice president, listened to the advice of his friend, Steve Ditko, and hired Giordano as an editor in April 68. So just, you know, a real sweet spot for comics that year. He edited Teen Titans, Aquaman, Young Love, and he started The Witching Hour book, which Alex Toth worked on, and we talked about a couple of weeks ago. He inked Neil Adams in Batman and Green Lantern, Green Arrow. So those sort of gorgeous Neil Adams, you know, which in many ways changed the landscape of art, you know. He was the inker on a lot of those pages, and an absolute class act. He left in 71 to join Continuity Associates Studio with Neil Adams, but he continued to work for DC as a penciler and inker. He and Marvel. He penciled some Wonder Woman. He penciled Sons of the Tiger, and he inked Ross Andrew in the Superman versus Spider-Man Treasury Edition, which probably is just one of the highlights of the century for me. That book, I love that book. Are you an owner of that book?
I'm not an owner of the book. I've seen the book and
you will love it, lucky enough
to look at it, but never to actually properly sit down with it as my own. And
yeah, if there was ever a book that was influential on this Man of Steel series, I think it's that one. It's that wide open, sleek, clearly defined fighting. You know, the Byrne, but you could see Byrne would redraw it, and it would be equally as nice. You know.
Yeah.
Returned in 1980 to DC Comics, became vice president between 83 and 93. And often used assistants to ink the backgrounds and stuff like that. His last work was on Jonah Hex 51, March 2010, the Joe Palmiotti, Justin Gray series, which is a great series, really good. A real landmark character. Like, they were talking about him on the Kayfabe Mark Miller interview that I listened to this morning. And I think Mark Miller said, look, I won't explain who Dick Giordano is, because anyone listening to this podcast will know who he is, and rightly so. If you're into comics and you don't know who he is, then, you know, go away and learn about him, because he's a great creator and a real sort of guiding light in DC for a long time. Good. Okay, so issue 4, Lex Luthor Strikes, aka Enemy Mines. This one had two titles. It had a title on the cover, and it had a title on the chapter 1, so there was obviously maybe a slight change, or sometimes they'd do that, wouldn't they? Sort of necessarily in line with everything. The covers often didn't mean anything to the inside sometimes.
No, it was sort of the era where the cover title was more the tagline than the title, but...
Yeah. So what we're looking at here is the Lex Luthor. I saw it described, I think it was Grant Morrison who said that Lex Luthor, he didn't like the redesign that Byrne gave him, because he went from being... like either a sort of crazy scientist or in a sort of space suit, or, you know, having gadgets, like in, you know, and being this sort of clever bank robbing villain or world takeover villain. And he just went into being a skinny kingpin with ginger hair, which is coloured red.
Fucking Grant Morrison. For me, Lex Luthor is the ultimate Superman villain, because Superman can't beat him with his superpowers.
Yeah.
He needs to outsmart him. But let's be fair, Lex Luthor's smarter than Superman. And Lex Luthor... you know, built himself up as a hero to the common people, which is the big shift for Lex Luthor. Is he's rejected by Lois Lane because she's chasing Superman. He's told, as you know, in this one, he's told by the mayor that he's no longer the most powerful man in Metropolis.
Yes.
And, you know, he's lost that crown as the king of Metropolis.
Yep.
Kind of thing. And that really puts his nose out of joint, especially when Superman rejects being bought by him as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, probably in the 80s was a decent sum, but was such a feeble sum.
Now, this is another time jump. So between each issues, we get a time jump, sometimes up to 18 months, don't we?
Yeah, this one's an 18-month jump, isn't it?
Yeah. So
again, they like to force that in the dialogue.
They do. Yeah, it's very exposition-y, isn't it?
I don't think I've ever like held a grudge and actually given specific date, month, week for when the person wronged me.
Now, this one, again, they're pushing the Lois Lane combo of being great at a job, slightly abrasive, you know, very driven, but also very saucy. So she's braless in a plunging neckline dress, and she appears early looking pretty saucy at Clark's door.
And being quite flirty with Clark as well when he's talking about how he takes his shape. She's like, you succeeded.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, she doesn't. She has no. There's no stepping back with her, is there? And he does that.
She sends very mixed messages.
Yeah, she does. The panel on page two at the bottom, where she's looking at a picture, and he does a very Chris Reeve. Oh, I've been working out. Pretends to be working out, and it's awkward. Oh my God, painful. You know, if you did that in real life, you'd be embarrassed for yourself for years, wouldn't you? After doing that, yeah. Even if she didn't see you. And then he says, "You look fantastic. That's some dress." All right, calm down, baby. Do you know what I mean? He must maybe like shoulder pads. Who knows?
It's his thought when he's in the bathroom. She's far too attractive, far too vivacious for me to let us stay enemies.
He wrote basically that down one as well. Yeah.
It's like, I fancy her so much that I can't be enemies with her. I want to plow her.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
I mean, Byrne was very problematic with his approach to some female characters. He's... thing with Big Barda is quite
that went very
notorious
weird.
She's essentially doing porn, isn't she?
so we get these little touches of flair for explanation of Superman's powers. So we get the fact that he burns off his own facial hair by using his heat vision in a bit of the ship that's sort of polished so it reflects it back onto his face, which is a clever little thing.
Yeah.
I remember even reading that as a kid and thinking, yeah, that's clever. I get that.
Totally. Yeah. And that he's done it so much that his face no longer burns or cuts.
Yeah.
Because the same with shaving, you build up a resistance to it kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I love the little detail of him putting on the electric razor. The fact he bought an electric razor just in case he ever has to shave when somebody's there. Hmm.
And then, of course, his mistake is he comes back in the room and Lois is lifting his dumbbells and she says, these are quite easy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they were old ones.
Lovely panel of her there as well.
Yeah.
Perfect.
His drawing of Lois in this is superb. The hair, everything.
Yeah. She's got that I'm a modern strong woman because she's got sort of shortish hair, isn't she?
Yeah, because it's sort of tied up at the back in a D, isn't it, kind of thing?
For a period was kind of like a shortcut, wasn't it?
Yeah.
To strong women.
The 80s power woman, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, yeah. Yeah. So we go to, he's got a yacht, which is bigger than the Queen Elizabeth liner or something, which is explained quite quickly.
The Yacht Britannia, Royal Yacht Britannia.
And they land on it on a helicopter.
I love the thing with that that sort of sets Luther up nicely as well is that they've landed on the roof of Clark's building.
That's right.
Like, I'm pretty sure that's illegal. It's like, yeah, but it's got LexCorp written on it.
Yeah, so we're setting him up, aren't we? Yeah.
So we're setting him up as the most powerful man in Metropolis.
Yeah, so that's the 3 points I wrote about Luther here I thought we could discuss. So one, he's above the law, so he considers himself totally above the law. Two, he's disgustingly rich, which we show off here. Anyone who can wear a waistcoat like that and a bow tie has got to be rich and not worried about where he looks. And three, he's completely and utterly smitten with Lois.
Yeah.
And actually lives almost like a fantasy life about how they're a couple in his head.
Well, he wants to own her, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
And he can't, and he's a man who's used to buying everything.
Yeah. So this is kind of a strange Lex Luthor because he's had quite a few wives. We get it's alluded to that he's had quite a few wives in his life, and you know he's more Trump than crazy scientist, isn't he? This bloke.
Yeah, I think a lot of them have been quite open in that Trump was the model, not necessarily that they knew where Trump was going at the time.
Yeah.
Because they even did that whole Lex Luthor autobiography that was a rip-off of Art of the Deal.
Yes,
the cover and everything.
Yeah. Yeah, very true.
But, I mean, that was for the time. But like I say, I think that works better. The trouble with mad scientist Lex Luthor is that he is a villain. The world knows he's a villain. So Superman can easily just take him in.
Yeah.
Whereas he can't with this Lex Luthor.
Yeah, that was the thing with Superman. He'd have an issue. He'd catch Lex. He'd put him in prison. You know, 6 months later, he'd escape. That was kind of how it worked. But this one, it's got more legs on it, hasn't it? Because of he's allowed to be sort of manipulative and, like we say, above the law in that way. You know.
Yeah. If he can't manipulate, he can buy his way out.
Yeah.
If he can't buy his way, he just has somebody get somebody to kill him.
Yeah. Now, I've got the issues to this. They're in a long box somewhere amongst my 400 long boxes. So I ended up looking at it, buying it on Comixology. Now, is it? I can hear you've got the issues or the trade in front of you.
I've got the trade. I've got the issues, but they're in a box. And
is his hair as red in the trade as it is on my backlit iPad?
It's pretty orange, yeah.
Oh, is it? Yeah,
but then that panel you sent me from the Batman one looks stunning in digital. I mean, it looks great in print as well, but it's just so much more vibrant in
the digital. Yeah, so that's one of the Vertigo ones we talked about where we're looking down on Superman behind the buildings. Yeah, yeah, no, that's a really... He does that well, Byrne. He does that sort of gap between the buildings perfectly, doesn't he? You know, he gives you a sense of depth and everything. Gorgeous, but... This one, he's got a sort of waistcoat. He's got a sort of pale bluey green waistcoat on, a white shirt, cream shirt, black shirt.
It's yellow, It's more yellow in my.
Yeah, and he's got bright red hair. My God, it looks like, you know, it looks like the sort of hair that our friend Sarah Harris dreams of having the colour in hers. You know, so to me, that's sort of the brightness of it. You know? She's going to kill me for that comment. Yes. Good.
Yeah, I ain't touching that one. You're on your own.
Yeah. Yeah, and Lois calls Lex full Fred Mertz. Now, did you know who Fred Mertz was?
I didn't. I had to Google it. But...
Oh, you did? Did you find out who he was? Did you want to tell us?
I can't remember now. Hang on.
He's a character from I Love Lucy.
Yeah.
So he's sort of balding character. So it's like a full-on diss about his hair, isn't it, that?
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
I always misremember that, because obviously with the radio adaptation, she does a different thing to him. It's like about him eating garlic instead, because I'm guessing that wouldn't play as well.
Okay, good stuff. The and then, of course, the ship is invaded by mercenaries who, in classic John Byrne style, look like they're probably Che Guevara's entourage.
Yeah.
Invaded the ship. It finishes strangely. So in classic Superman style, Clark steps forward, gets knocked out and thrown overboard, so everyone thinks he's died.
Yeah.
And it's down kind of to Lois to sort of save the day by kicking people in the bollocks and killing people with a machine gun, which
Superman picks the ship up out of the water.
Yeah.
And then and you get the word balloon of it's strange how things feel lighter when I'm flying.
Yeah. Outright. Okay, so why does he pick it up?
I honestly don't know.
Because
he takes
it
to Luther's Island, but that doesn't solve the problem that's going on board.
No, so she's firing machine guns, her life's at stake.
Because she kicks one of them in the nuts, pretty much, don't she? Grabs his gun.
Chuck. That's the noise when she kicks him in the nuts. And then she fires a machine gun off. So she's clearly killing people while he decides he'd just carry the ship to a different bit of the bay or something.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about that.
That can only be in there to establish how strong Superman is and that things are different when he lifts them out of water, in the air and on the ground kind of thing.
I think you're right. Yeah.
But there's no other reason for that to be there.
No. Right, so we talk a little bit about... Let's do a little bit on Lex. So Lex Luthor appeared. His first appearance was in... Did you know this one?
The number's gone from my head, but...
Action Comics 23, 1940. Yeah. Jerry Siegel, Joe Shuster, obviously. When he was originally created, he actually had ginger hair, if you can believe it. And then he was later...
He was just called Luthor then, wasn't he?
I think you're right, yeah. And later on, there was a mistake where he was mistaken for another character and drawn as bald. And that kind of stuck from then onwards up until now. Byrne had him as a self-made millionaire. He'd come from a hard life in suicide slum. He'd had abusive parents. So he was very much a sort of self-made millionaire. He wasn't the crazy scientist we talked about before. But we do, however, later get a glimpse of the super suit, the power suit that... it's on and off. You see it.
I mean, I think this Luthor is still a scientist. It's established later on in the run.
Yeah.
That this Luthor is a genius still.
Yeah.
Like I say, that's his one upmanship on Superman, is that he is a genius. And Superman is not... I love Superman, but he's not the smartest guy in the world.
Yeah.
Hence lifting a boat out of the water instead of just dealing with the problem actually on it.
Yeah. He can't be, because he'd be the whole game then, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
You know.
Well, that's it. That's what I mean with this Luthor, is that he can't beat him with his powers.
Yeah. So it ends quite well. Superman gets Luthor banged up. Luthor gets out straight away, and there's a sort of confrontation.
I love how Superman, Lex Luthor's, and then the mayor tells Alpha Man and Metropolis anymore and tells Superman to die. And then his face just drops into that real sullen.
Yeah, it does.
You told a kid he can't have that second bar of chocolate.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great last panel. There's no sort of definitive last panels in this. It is very much sort of notes from history for me, this series. Even when I was young and reading this, I was thinking, right, this is just us taking steps through Superman's history, establishing it in it's slightly different ways.
Snapshots, you know? Isn't it?
Yeah.
Early years. Like I say, I would have preferred it to be shorter than the 5 to 8 years that it seems to run.
Yeah.
Partly because I struggle to buy that it'd take Lex Luthor that long to start delving into it. He's out of Metropolis for a year to begin with, fair enough. But then once he's back, I imagine he would be full on focus of getting Superman.
Yeah, exactly.
Either to buy him or to take him down.
Yep.
And
so now we're on to... Let's get on to issue five. Look at us. I always say let's do an hour, and we never do. So let's get on to issue five. The Beast Within, which is essentially the new origin of Bizarro, with a couple of other people making their steps back into the series.
Well, the mirror cracked, isn't it, inside?
Is it the mirror cracked? Yes, it is. Of course it is.
Look, so basically, at the end of the last issue, Lex Luthor's told him he's going to kill him. He'll know he's killed him. The world will know he's killed him, but nobody will ever be able to prove it, because that's sort of the power of Lex Luthor.
Yeah, I get you. Yeah.
Then it goes into book five, setting up Lex's first plan.
Okay.
So, although he doesn't set Bizarro up as a thing against Superman, he sets him up as a means with finding information on Superman, doesn't it?
Yeah, so in this, so Bizarro is... He's not this creature from another dimension. He is, in fact, a failed experiment in Luthor's labs.
To clone Superman.
Yeah, by a typical white-coated, bow-tied-wearing scientist. Dr. Dunn. Yeah. And it's a sort of failed experiment. So we get two introductions in this. So we get Bizarro, but we also get Lucy Lane. Had you heard of Lucy Lane before this?
Only because of the TV series.
Right, okay. So created by Otto Binder and Kurt Swan. The Mighty Swan. First appeared in Superman's Pal, Jimmy Olsen, 36. In the Silver Age was an air stewardess, which I think she still is in this, isn't she?
Yeah, because she has that clunky dialogue of nobody wants a blind air stewardess.
That's right, yeah. Jimmy Olsen was always a little bit sweet on her and always trying to romance her. And I think they actually, very briefly, before it was sort of... they didn't like the idea of the creators, so she got married to Jimmy Olsen in Jimmy Olsen 100. Now, in this, she appears as Lois's blind sister, who turns up. It's quite tragic. She suffered this blindness. But when she sort of encounters Bizarro, her blindness begins to go away somehow, and I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah, because she was blinded by people trying to hijack the plane who threw some chemicals in her face, which I honestly can't remember whether it's in the comics as well, but in the Dirt Mags audio one,
right,
they established that the shipment of chemicals they threw in the face was what was on the way to Hong Kong, Lex's Hong Kong lab.
Right, yeah.
To make Bizarro, so the composition build-up of Bizarro, the dust that comes off him,
yep,
is the same as what blinded her, so by going through that process, you know,
yeah,
sci-fi shit. Same stuff that blinded you, tweak slightly, can cure you.
Yeah.
So, but like I said, I don't know whether that was ever actually explained in the comic.
Yeah.
It's certainly not in this comic. I don't know whether it was done somewhere else.
No, I can't remember. But as part of the sort of the time jump, Clark's got a little bit of a swagger about him now. He's got this sort of quite cool black shirt on, hasn't he? Looks quite good on him. He's clearly much more comfortable with his Clark Kent persona. And he's now sort of bantering with Lois in the
I think it's been 5 years, because I'm sure Lois has a line of dialogue about she's waited 5 years for Superman to kiss her and it's this thing instead.
I
don't believe it. 5 years I've been dreaming of being kissed by Superman, now it's this thing.
Yeah, there's a couple of chilling moments in this. He does well with Bizarro. You can see Byrne likes him, and there's a couple of shocking moments. You get a page turn where Superman confronts the Bizarro, who's wearing both the Superman costume and a sort of strange facsimile of the Clark Kent clothes.
Yeah.
And Superman confronts him, and he turns round, and you're presented by... And it's a nice little moment, three-panel page, where he's confronted by him, and he's sort of shocked by him. And he gets the drop on Superman, doesn't he? Yeah,
he gets sucker-punched. And
a lovely panel where he sort of bangs him out the panel, which is
smashes him into the side of a bus.
Yeah, and I love the way Byrne puts Superman's arms, and you know, he overhangs the panel to show his flight into the air to give it that sort of 3D element. It was really nice. So Bizarro is that difficult one. He defeats him, but he kind of does. He completely explode him. I think he does, doesn't he?
Yeah, because the implication is that Bizarro realized that he could save Lucy, or right, save Lucy's sight. So he flies headlong into Superman, and Superman flies headlong into him.
Yeah,
knowing that the dust would then cure Lucy's blindness.
Yeah,
is the implication. It's never specifically said.
Yeah, I get you.
It's just sort of done in Superman's last line of, you know, I didn't know that, but somehow I think he did.
Yeah, I get you. Yeah.
That, you know, even Bizarro's got Superman's, because he's a clone of him, he's still got his innate sense of good and sacrifice for the benefit of others kind of thing.
And then we kind of get Superman's in trouble really for the first time properly, isn't he?
Yeah.
Where it's like, there's a real, he's trouble, this guy. He could lose because he's his equal in strength.
Yeah, it's the first time he's gone up with somebody whose powers match his.
Yeah. Yeah, quite a strong issue, but none of them are Shakespeare. Do you know what I mean? They're light comics, aren't they?
It's five good standalone issues that has been packed into a mini series. Now a mini series would be six, overarching issues.
Yeah.
Whereas this is very much, you could read any one of these and not have to worry about reading the one that came before or the one that came after.
Yeah.
Kind of thing, which is kind of what comics was.
Yeah, so every comic can be someone's first comic, la, 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 la. Yeah, that sort of thing.
It's a nice jumping on point for people, I think, which, you know, it was designed to be. So in that respect, it succeeds in each issue.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I was following this on as a kid. I was reading it as it came out, and there was a buzz about it. And I think the first issue sold about 200,000 copies, pretty good for it at the time. And it was going along and going along, and I was finding it interesting, and the little twists and turns, the changes, and I mean, I'd follow Byrne to anything, do you know what I mean? I would read anything by him, so I followed him over to DC. And this last issue confused me then, confuses me now, I'll be honest with you.
It's a something and nothing issue.
It really is. Return to
Very
Smallville,
much.
The epic conclusion on the cover. It's got now grown Jailbait Lana's on the cover there in her green jacket and blue jeans, typical sort of Byrne clothing sense. And inside it's called The Haunting. So I do really like that first page, the flight over the fields of, near Smallville, on the outskirts of Smallville, and over the lorries and the fields and, you know, the cornfields and stuff like that. Beautiful.
It's a different angle on Superman as well.
Yeah. I think you can see his Neil Adams influences in that panel, definitely, from the sort of the foreshortening and, you know, he's flying out the panel almost, isn't he? And, you know, really lovely page. And it looks great on an iPad as well, I have to say.
There's
really
some lovely panels in this. The, like, shot of the farm in silhouette with the red, orange and yellow sky behind it is beautiful.
Yeah.
But, and again, you know, a fairly simple looking panel. And there's a lovely one of Lana's farm.
Right. That's not a euphemism, by the way.
No. That's it's like a crooked fence in the foreground and then it leads off to it in the background.
Right.
It's on page 14 of that issue. I don't have page numbers of...
Ah, okay. Oh, I see it. Yeah, it's lovely. Yeah.
But it's a really nice... You know, there's nothing exciting in it. It's just a country scene kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it's just really nicely done.
And something about this issue, I know it's got this sort of layup where it's kind of a ghost. It's kind of an echo of the past. It's Jor-El appears in the, the Kent's kitchen, speaks to Superman, and then he finds himself outside confronted by Lana.
And a shocking waste of a pie in this as well.
Yeah,
can't stand for that sort of thing.
And it's kind of okay. Pacing wise at the start, it's fine. It's got some interesting pacing. So there's this.
It tries to do two things that I think needed to be their own issues.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Which, again, I don't know whether it was Byrne giving himself some wiggle room to go back to if he wanted to. Because I don't think they go back to Krypton on Byrne's run, from best of my memory, but I might be wrong.
Right, okay. Right, it's a while since I've read it, so yeah, I'll take your word.
Yeah.
Yeah,
like I say, I might be wrong. They might do into it more, but it does seem to sort of wrap up that you get very little from Jor-El himself, but then it's a Superman's process in it all afterwards. He's like, now I know all this shit and all this shit and all this shit.
Yeah. Yeah, it's also the Lana episode for me.
Yeah.
It's the Lana issue. There's something about it that is an echo of the previous thing that I talked about with Pete Watson, where Lana was Superboy's love and Lois is Superman's love. You know?
Yeah.
And now that we've done away with the Superboy mythos, so the whole Superboy thing's gone. There's no Superboy anymore. We've dispensed with that, because Superman doesn't get into costume till the significant amount of period of time that he's been in Metropolis. You know.
Yeah.
So we have to explain the Lana connection, and he has revealed himself to Lana. You know, he's explained himself to her about his powers and stuff.
The night he leaves her.
Yeah, and it's an interesting moment. You know,
there's that nice line, isn't it, that he kissed her on the forehead like a brother would kiss a sister.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. Yeah, it really is. And the counterpoint between country living, probably quite a tough girl. She's had to sort of, you know, work on farms and stuff like that. Lana, with the sort of sassy, we'll still kick you in the balls, tough city dwelling Lois. You know, there's that counterpoint, isn't there? Yeah, very interesting. What I think he does, though, I think he rushes this issue.
Yeah, like I say, the whole Jor-El thing with it's, as he flies off to think about it, that's when he starts learning everything. The Krypton stuff very much could have done with being explored more somewhere else rather than shoehorned into this.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Or it should have been its own thing, and the Lana thing should have been dealt with elsewhere.
Yeah, it's very exposition-y. It's a tad overwritten. So this is, I'm going to read one panel's dialogue. I'm not sure, but my best guess is some kind of self-powered holographic projection. Whatever it was vastly more sophisticated than anything modern Earth science could produce. Your metal shovel blade must have shorted it out somehow. Only the wooden handle saved you from electrocution. It seemed to be recording of some kind, but more than just a recording, it reacted to me. It called me. He called me his son, his Jonathan. That's one panel.
Yeah.
So he's done a lot in that panel.
He's been very good with dialogue throughout. It's quite nice, quick, easy read. This last issue is a chore.
Really is, isn't it? Really, he jams it in there, you know.
It never sits right with me as well, the way he flies off from his parents. Because there's no, thanks for saving me, Dad. I just need a little bit of a minute. Or, you know, I love you both. I'll be back soon. It's just kind of like, I need some space. Fuck off.
Yeah. And you can see the influence of them. The first two Donna movies, you know, the first two Christopher Reeves movies. You can see the influence of that because we get the equivalent of Superman flying around the Earth.
Yeah.
You know, in the movies where, you know, you saw the look on his face and you realised what he was thinking about it. But basically, the last three issues of this are Superman on his own, talking to himself.
Yeah.
Deciding what his future is. And we get the hero pose at the end of the issue, but it's something of a hollow ending for me, I found that.
Yeah, I find it very a flat sort of ending. To me, a better ending would have been the Luthor telling Superman he's a dead man.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. Yeah, totally.
I mean, there's some nice little touch in this that build what to come without actually rubbing it in your nose. So you get the kryptonite as Krypton explodes hitting the ship.
Yeah.
So at the end of the prologue, you just see a yellow beam of kryptonite hitting the ship.
Yeah.
Which you don't necessarily notice at the time. When him and Jonathan go to... When Jonathan shows him the ship for the first time, as they drive away, there's the figure in shadow.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
With the hat on, which I'm assuming is Professor Emmett Vale, who then builds Bizarro.
Right. Okay, now I did wonder that myself. I wasn't sure whether that was... It can't be Luther at that point, surely,
no,
can it?
No, because for years I couldn't work it out, and then it all sort of fell into place. And then before Luther confronts him, he says that somebody's taking photos of him. And again, I think that's Emmett Vale.
Right, yes.
Because in the first issue, the Bizarro issue, he finds his lair where he's found the ship. It was Emmett Vale that took the ship.
Right.
And got the kryptonite to power Brainiac.
Yeah, that makes sense. I made note of that to talk to you about that hidden figure, because it's not the Jor-El character. There's no reason for it to be. It's got to be him, of whom we've seen, anyway.
No explanation for it. And because Jonathan's shown in shadow with a hat on as well, you kind of think, is that a mistake? Is Clark just nicked the car? Is that Jonathan looking like Clark? What the fuck?
Yeah, it's a bit of a strange one, isn't it? Yeah. So we end on that. We end on that that hero, you know, standing on some very sort of Byrne-esque rocks on taking the side of a cliff, and the sky's behind him and his cloak's in the wind. And the last line, what does it say? The last line is, it was Krypton that made me Superman, but is it Earth that makes me human? And you get that very sort of, I don't know.
Which is a nice last line, but it's just, it feels a bit flat after everything that came before. There's so much exposition dump in the middle.
Yeah. I remember reading this as a kid and thinking, well, how powerful is he then? What can he do? We're told he's been depowered, and you can see that he's not, you know, traveling backwards in time and stuff, but we haven't had any real tests of his strength. The only thing we've really had is him running straight into Bizarro, who is equally powered, so it's hard to make your mind up about what the power set is at the time, you know.
Yeah,
it's an interesting one. It's
I think it was laying the groundwork for what followed.
Yes, I think it's hard to judge it as a standalone series because it was designed as being, you know, the trailer for the movie.
Almost. Yeah. Because, yeah, like I say, the shadowy figure, all that stuff comes into play. The scrapbook comes back into play.
Yep.
With that great issue where one of Luther's people dumps all the data into a computer and it comes up revealing that Clark Kent is Superman and Luther won't buy it.
Right, okay. Right.
He's like, nobody that powerful would ever hide themselves as a mere mortal.
Yeah, I get you. Very clever.
Yeah. And that's Luther's big weakness, is that, you know, his arrogance and his arrogance for power.
Yep.
And how other people would deal with power is kind of his downfall.
Yeah.
But I like it. It laid the groundwork for the era of Superman I love. That's the Mike Carlin era.
Yeah.
From that Masters of Modern Masters volume, the John Byrne one, he says that he didn't get along with Andy Heffler, who was the editor when he came onto it. So DC moved him to make Byrne's life easier and brought Mike Carlin in, who, according to Byrne, had just been fired from Marvel at that time. I don't know whether he was fired or he left, but Byrne says he was fired.
Right. And then, probably liked him for that reason only.
Yeah, so Mike Carlin came in as an assistant editor, I think with Byrne sort of acting as an assistant editor as well.
Yeah.
With no main editor kind of thing. And then, yeah, Mike Carlin became the eventual editor, and that became the era of the Super Summit and planning year-long story arcs, which led to the death and return and funeral for friends.
It's a great little period. I actually really like that period of Superman history. I like the one, and I still will go back and read the sort of one and done stories from the Silver and Bronze Age, but I kind of like that for a nostalgia point of view of thinking back and reading it. I enjoyed it as it was coming out, and I followed it, and we really didn't know where it was going at that time. You know, you were really cynical, I suppose, back then. You know?
It tidied the world up nicely as well. I mean, I know, you know, with ground in Bizarro and more of a reality than the Bizarro world thing, I know that came back into play eventually.
Yeah.
And with, you know, keeping Supergirl dead but bringing the Matrix character in, so you still have Supergirl. I liked that it was Superman was the last survivor of Krypton.
Yes. Yeah.
Always starts to feel a little bit cheap, where it's like, well, his cousin survived. Oh, and this guy survived. Oh, and this guy survived.
Yes. Yeah, I know what you mean.
And I know they bring Zod and that in. And
we're doing what we talked about at the start there. He's taking it back to basics. He's stripping it all down.
It's a respectful reboot. In this age of reboots where people... It's like Court of Owls. My big problem with Court of Owls is that it takes the basic thing of Batman and decides to build on it.
Yeah.
Not in a good way. By completely changing the origin of Batman, you completely change Batman. The whole thing for Batman is that it was a senseless crime. It's a meaningless crime. There was no reason for it. It was just, you know, an unfortunate thing. A mugger happened to kill his parents.
Yeah.
And that was the whole thing. It was a random act of violence. By putting a conspiracy behind that,
it completely changes the origin of Batman. Yeah, it does.
It's like adding story to something that doesn't need story. And this, I feel, is a respectful one, that it adds elements, but not so much that it completely rewrites what had come before.
Yeah,
I know a lot of people at the time were very anti-Byrne's take on it.
Yeah.
Because it's the same thing with us now. If they completely revamped Superman now, it'd be always not my Superman.
Yeah, I know. It's a funny one, isn't it? And it's okay revamping or rebooting, but do it well. That's how I see it. And do it in... These characters we followed for many decades. And
I think we know that we're familiar with them. The core of who Superman is.
Yeah, that
was the problem when they did the new 52, is they completely changed the kind of character Superman was, which I know some people liked, and that's awesome for them. And, you know, you could argue that it's possibly right. But for me, the whole thing of Superman is that Superman is a symbol of goodness and hope.
Okay, yeah.
And that's you kind of lose that when you start to complicate him and make him a conflicted character.
That leads very, very neatly, Stewpot, into my question as well to you, is what is your perfect Superman story? So we've been through this. We've had a good read of it. We've seen what's going on. We've seen the reboot. What would be your perfect Superman story? So if you're given it to take over, what would it be?
I really like the small stuff with Superman.
Okay, yeah.
The big stuff's cool, and I like those as like an event thing, but I really like the small thing. Bendis did it really well when he did his Man of Steel miniseries.
Yeah. I like that series, yeah.
It's the little moments, like the, you know, don't say these certain words because he will hear.
Yeah.
And then the guy makes a reference to the crime they're about to commit and Superman grabs them. Or the whole thing with the firefighter who whispers something under breath and then Superman replies and she's like, right, super hearing.
Right, okay.
I love those little character elements. Superman. I love, there's a lot in this of the second issue where Superman's going around helping people.
Yes, I love that issue. I think that's probably my high point as well. I found the first issue, like, I had to get through it because I knew it all.
The first
the
issue,
issue, you throw yourself into it, don't you? Yeah, yeah.
I love that the parents are still alive. My perfect Superman would... Yeah, you'd either have John Byrne on art or Dan Jurgens on art or Brett Breen in that lot. That's my era of Superman. The only one from that era that I was never a massive fan of the art was the one who did Man of Steel, the ongoing series Man of Steel. What was his name? John Bogdanovich.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I love other stuff he's done, but it's just, even reading it at the time, his Man of Steel... Because it's a very different style to everybody else's.
Yes, it is. Sort of slightly scratchier than some of the sort of cleaner.
Yeah, it always looked a little bit like he just knocked that out quickly. And I'm sure he didn't, and that was his style, and I don't want to, you know, cast dispersions. But it just wasn't for me.
Yeah, I get you.
Kind of thing. But again, I know a lot of people that like his style, and that's awesome for them.
Yeah, they're wrong, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the great thing about art, isn't it?
Yeah. Did you follow Byrne elsewhere after this? So would you, because you enjoyed this, did you go and buy any other stuff of his?
I didn't. I read some of the other DC stuff he did. He did some Wonder Woman, didn't he? Did he do New Gods?
Yes, no. He did.
Yes, he did.
The Blood of the Demon, I think, is a forgotten classic. I really like that series.
He did something with Blue Devil as well, didn't he? Or did he bring Blue Devil into Superman? I can't remember now.
I think he was in Superman, yeah. He did some strange stuff at Dark Horse. We got Babe, Danger Unlimited. And then IDW, we got Doomsday, FX, The Highways, Trio... You know, I going back a bit, I really enjoy his early stuff. So his the stuff he did on the Champions, he did an issue with that, was gorgeous. The X-Men, obviously, Alpha Flight, obviously, Team Up, obviously, Iron Fist, obviously. You know, some amazing books there. I mean, he made Wood God an interesting character. Yeah. That's my name at night.
But no, initially I wasn't aware of the artist. I mean, I used to read comics and focus on the characters. It was only, you know... after pouring over it for so long that you start to become aware of the names and that. So for a long time, it didn't even occur to me that it was different people drawing it, apart from the massive difference in style.
Yeah.
Because I was just so engrossed in the character kind of thing, and I was young.
Yeah.
But I looked, and I've read some of his Marvel stuff. I'm more of a DC guy than a Marvel guy, which is weird because we had more Marvel comics over here than DC comics. But
well, funny enough, all the Scottish people we've had on, we've had quite a few North of the Border people on, and they seem to have had a better... DC distribution than Marvel, but I always thought, certainly in London and the sort of home counties, we seem to have a better Marvel distribution. I'm not sure why that was. Must have been a reason.
Yeah, it just seemed to be. I mean, I didn't go to the estate, the news agents with my dad all the time, and so I didn't always pick them up. So it was sporadic when I did pick them up. I think after I got issue 3 of that UK reprint, it wasn't until about issue 45 that I picked another one up.
Right, okay.
Just because I happened to see it, or I happened to have the 40p that I'd not spent on sweets.
Yeah, I'll get you.
When you could get a comic for 40p.
Yeah, those are the days. Maybe at the Mart. Right, so in the Superman mythos, we do like an out of 10 thing occasionally on this. So in the Superman mythos, what do you give this out of 10? The whole of the Superman range of comics.
This Man of Steel or this hit period of...
No, just Man of Steel. So just Steel. The six issues, yeah.
I'd probably give it a 6. I love it.
Okay. I was going to go 6 as well, man. Yeah, that's good.
It's problematic. It does its job.
Yeah. And
I don't think you can take that away from it. It's, in retrospect, it's clunky in places. I think other people took it and built on it better. Like I say, the Dirt Mags audio one tightened it up into like a 2-hour movie kind of thing with some of the stuff from his other early issues in Superman.
Yeah.
And tightened that up into a nice arc, which... The only downside for that is that I misremember that as from the comic sometimes more than it just being from there, if that makes sense.
Yeah, those audio plays Dirk Maggs and others did, they're stuck in your head visually, aren't they? I can still remember moments from them that I've listened
like
to.
Like I say, they're still the voices that I hear when I read it. Yep. So like Lois Lane is Lorelei King, Stuart Milligan's Superman, William Hoopkins is Lex Luthor. Even down to the way I read it is their performance of it kind of thing.
Okay. Yeah. Even had Dave Gibbons in it. What's that all about?
Yeah, it was in the trial one, wasn't it?
Yeah. We still need the Spider-Man releasing.
See, I've got that on CD. I won that in a Radio 1 competition.
Oh, you told me that. Yeah, it's great. I remember listening to that daily for 3 minutes a day on the Zoe Ball show or something. Or Steve Wright or something. Yeah, really good.
It's I think it's all on YouTube.
Oh, is it? Okay, I'll have a look.
I know Dirk shared it before because ordinarily he wouldn't, but he said because you can't get it.
Yeah.
Because William... Dufresne, who played Spider-Man, died recently, and I think Dirk shared it then.
Oh, good stuff.
I'll have a look. And like I say, the Byrne stuff opened the door for the Mike Carlin era, so just after the return of Superman, which, like I say, had Dan Jurgen, Jerry Ordway. I love Jerry Ordway.
Yeah, me too.
Why there isn't more Jerry Ordway in comics? Why there isn't any more of any of these people?
He's still active. He did a Invaders, didn't he? One-off Marvel thing a year ago.
I kind of feel like he should be on everything.
Still, Pete Watson said exactly the same thing, man, when I was chatting to him.
That's right. Roger Stern, like I say, John Bogdanov. Again, I've only ever read names already. And Louise Simonson as well, who wrote Man of Steel. Love Louise Simonson.
Yeah, I love Wheezy. Yeah, do. And he would name characters. He's very friendly with Louise, isn't he? And he named a character Wheezy, didn't he? I think I can't remember which run that was in. He had a Wheezy character. I can't remember which series it is. But yeah, he's very friendly with him. And in fact, if you look at the sci-fi documentary on John Byrne, he's they appear and say, look, he can be difficult. But
yeah.
You know, Walt and her appear. And two nicer people in comics you couldn't happen to meet. You know,
that's it. It's...
Yeah.
But like I say, the whole death funeral return off, which was what I was going to initially suggest, but you kind of need to read the death, the funeral, and the return all as one
thing. It's a long read, my friend.
So I'm not going to dump like 50 odd issues on you.
Yeah, no, it was a nice little experiment, this, and I certainly hadn't read it for probably since it came out. And
I've not read it for a while,
loads of it.
I say, so some of it was clunkier than I remembered it being, but a lot of it I remember more through the glass of the prism of the radio play. And it led to, obviously, it inspired a lot going forward. A lot of Superman mythos still goes from that. Inspired Lois and Clark, which is a series that I love just because of the age I was at the time, obviously, and the Ruby Spears Superman cartoon.
Right, okay, yeah.
Which had some pedigree on it with Marv Wolfman and Gil Kane involved as well.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And, but yeah, and then, like I say, the radio plays and that, and I just, yeah. So on a personal level, I probably rate it higher, but as an actual mini series, I think it is a 6.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, kind of almost does what it says on the tin, and the last issue kind of fucking confused me a bit.
It's got some lovely art in it that I do like.
To die for. Yeah.
Go back and flip through. Like I say, there's some lovely panels of the Batman stuff.
Yeah.
Even the ones where it's like the Lex Luthor one where the bottom of the panel is just Clark's head and Lois's head.
Yeah.
Just cut off at the neck on white, where it's kind of like, shit, we need to squeeze this in somewhere. We've got a bit of space at the bottom of this page.
Yeah, he uses white. There's a really lovely moment with Lucy Lane where she's kind of on her own. Yeah. And he moves the whole panel to the right, so she's just sitting on this table, and it's a lovely use of bleakness and stuff. Yeah, really, really beautiful.
Yeah,
right.
It really shows her despair kind of thing.
Good. We're running on. So what we're going to do is we're going to go to our sponsor, and then we're going to just have a quick chat about what you got going on at the moment, babes.
Cool.
So if you just pause a minute for our sponsor.
Yep.
Ever wake up covered in dried bodily fluids and a raging hangover, wondering who the fuck you slept with and what shit you did with them last night? I know I have. So why not earn money while strangers bang your back doors in and give you crabs? Why not become a prozzy?
Yeah, he's
out of prison, so he's back now. That's good, I'm glad.
I gotta be honest, Pete's really diversified comic house. I know there's no money in comics, but...
Yeah. I have never caught crabs off Pete. I'd like to point that out. Yeah.
Okay. No, I don't think I did either. So.
No, good.
I brought them with me.
You're the start. You're the start of the infection. You're the R number. Or is the okay? So you have put off. So we've got no Troops next year. It's the following year. Is that right?
Yeah, I delayed it. It didn't seem right with what was going on to expect people to pay for tables with no income, and it also didn't seem fair on the other events for us, because, you know, we had our event this year. We were lucky, we got in just under the line kind of thing. So it opens it a little bit more for people to have a bit more room to play with Route 3 scheduling their events.
Yeah, that's very true.
If they wanted to, obviously they don't have to. Plus, you know, you don't know what's going on, so it's best to just take a year off kind of thing, and hopefully it'll work out.
I mean, slowly the pins keep dropping, don't they, this year? So they keep, I think we've just had a lot of events towards the end of the summer cancel now. So,
well, we've always said we wouldn't announce an event that we weren't going to put on.
Yep.
And, you know, we can't definitively say that. Obviously, you can't say you can definitely put anything on, you know,
Asterisk
or Strike or whatever. But, you know, with all good intentions going forward, we would definitely, if we announce an event, we're definitely putting it on, barring acts of God kind of thing.
I actually can see the first event that comes up after this lockdown is going to be the biggest party in the history of the comics conventions, I think.
Yeah, I'm really hoping it's Thought Bubble.
But... Yeah, me too, man. Me too. Yeah, you got a table at Thought Bubble this year?
I did, yeah. I applied sort of on a lark. And
good, mate. What an event. Yeah, really looking forward to that. And not that yours is. Yours is very enjoyable. I was in, as me and Falpy always say, the night before is always the best at your place because we have a right laugh.
Yeah, I love it. I only really do it for the night before. It's just an elaborate thing to have a get together the night before
and get on the piss. Yeah. Now you are busy making your own comics at the moment. You're trying to draw something every day, but out of that I see every so often the formation of a page that is on its way. So I know you've tried a bit of work with markers over the last few days, but before that I'm seeing some panels. So is that a comic you're working on again, or
the panels are separate. I've got a sketchbook that I do a drawing a day in, which was just a thing to challenge myself to draw something every day kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which, obviously, because that's in that book, it doesn't count for the doing the comic pages kind of thing. But it's more a warm-up thing as well before I go into drawing something proper kind of thing. So it's hit and miss with it. I use it to design characters sometimes. Sometimes I'll just mindlessly draw and create a story around that character as I'm drawing it kind of thing. So it's a notebook that leads to another notebook kind of thing.
Yeah. The marker stuff you've been doing is a real step up, man. I'm really liking what you're doing there.
It's just experimenting and playing around because fuck it.
Yeah, no, you're not wrong. Yeah, no, I wish I did it more. It's,
Nobody's going to my page and being like, I want to hire this. Oh, that looks shit. No, I'm not going to hire him now. So I'm very much doing it as a playing around, sort of just trying different techniques, that sort of thing, and putting it out there. And if other people like it or are like, oh, he's doing it, I'll have a go.
So we're going to get a comic out of you. Is that the plan?
That's the plan, yeah. Irrelevance, the one I'm working on at the moment.
Yeah.
Which is a little bit Superman inspired. It's basically about a superhero who kind of dies. The world thinks he's dead, but he hasn't actually died, but he decides to play on the fact that he's died.
Right.
So the world misses him. A bit like the world missed Superman kind of thing.
Okay. Yeah.
But then he discovers that the world kind of moves on. So when he's planning his big comeback, the world no longer needs him.
Oh, interesting. That's an interesting concept.
He basically become irrelevant because he's only ever been a superhero. It's sort of like him then after that, what's his place in the world now kind of thing.
And yeah, I get you.
So a That's little bit stuff, man. Superman, but a little bit Kirby enthusiasm as well kind of thing.
Ideal. Yeah.
He's kind of, everybody's ungrateful anyway, so he doesn't really see why he should.
Yeah. And the podcast rocks on. So you for those that haven't listened to, they've never listened to The Nerds Who Haunt Themselves, it is both comics, working on art, you know, crafts, and you also do a movie special every so often as well, don't you?
Yes. So we do the main Nerds one, which is me and Andy just talking shit. Usually we end up talking about drawing and that, because obviously he's an artist as well.
Yeah.
You know, obviously not as good as me, but...
No, clearly
not. He tries, bless him.
He's getting there.
Then we do the movie one, which is And Why Not, which a guest comes on and picks a film that they love, and we talk about that for an hour or so, a bit like this, but with a film.
Yep, I get you.
And then I do Why Comics as well, which a guest comes on, I ask them the question, why comics? And then however they interpret that, we have a conversation about comics for an hour or so.
Man. I like that one. Yeah, I really enjoy that.
They've all been on hiatus for a bit, just because of we usually take a break for Troops, and then with everything else that's been going on, I've just been so busy at work.
Yep.
It's having the time, but And Why Not's gradually coming back, and then I'm going to be setting up some Why Comics ones as well, just hitting people up to pop on as a guest kind of thing.
Good stuff, man. I've been on them all. I keep coming on. I'm like a bad Benny.
Coming on you. I really enjoy doing the ones with you and Tom, the nerd specials where we pick a subject and sort of...
Yeah, no, I enjoy that. Yeah, Tom's a sensible guy. We've had him on here, actually. We've got him coming back on. He's picked a book already, so we've got another one with him soon, but yeah.
He's a greedy bastard, isn't he?
Isn't he just? Yeah, those Scottish people. Good. So there you go. I'll get the links out of you in a second. So hold on, listener, and you'll get Stuart's links out of him. There you have it. So you can decide whether you want to pick up Man of Steel. I've got to tell you, it's probably worth it, even if it's purely from a comics history point of view.
So even as a time capsule, I think it's worth picking up and reading.
Yeah, totally. And it's about to come. It's about to get reissued in trade. I think as of June, I think we're getting...
They're doing a hardback edition, aren't they?
Right. Brilliant.
I believe. Yeah. So I'm tempted to dip again.
Yeah, I know, me too. Because I don't have a trade of it. I've got the issues and I've got Comixology. That's all I've got. So I'm tempted to just put it on the shelf, man. It's like it is. It's an event, isn't it? And let's face it, I talked about last week with Eamon. That period in the 80s is a sweet spot for amazing books, isn't it? Yeah,
well, like Eamon said, you had that. You had Born Again,
Watchmen, Dark Knight, Longbow Hunters. Yeah, it's all there. Just amazing stuff. So you can find me over at neverironanything.blogspot.com. You can buy my comics at neverironanything.bigcartel.com. You can follow me on Twitter at ezoyes. Please pop over and listen to a proper podcast at the Nerds Who Haunt Themselves. Where can we find that, Stuart?
It's on Podbean. If you just search Nerds Who Haunt Themselves, everything's released through that channel. So you'll find all three on there, the episodes for all three on there.
Brill. And where can we find your art?
My art on Instagram as Stuart Thinks He Can Draw, which is underscored between each word, and I've got a Facebook page, which is, you can either search Stuart Thinks He Can Draw, or if you put in facebook.com/ Stuart Can't Draw,
right? Seems to be an ongoing theme. You're gonna have to change that, man, because I would has to guess you can fucking draw. So we need to get that nailed down.
Needs to be Stuart Can Draw is just arrogant.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, we're not Americans.
If they're going by Stuart Can't Draw, they're going to be at best pleasantly surprised.
Good. What an episode. There we go. A lovely, another bit of Superman history. So we'll be getting some more soon. Really enjoyed that, man. Thanks for that. Really good.
It was great.
And we've got Watch Out World. John Ottaway is on his way next.
Ah, Christ. That's a sign of the apocalypse, isn't it?
Gonna go fucking bent. John said, oh, why don't you cover this? I said, well, why don't you come on and cover it, Mr. O? So he says, all right, so we've got one next week. No, it's not next week. When are we doing it? We're doing it Monday. It's coming your way on Monday.
Awesome.
So listen out for that one. A little bit of a surprise. We won't surprise you with the subject, but John's always good. John's the a comedy hand grenade. Something's going to go off, I think, at any point during that conversation. I get where we were, John. He's a good friend of ours and a big supporter of all of us small pressers. So thanks for coming on. So I'm back to the script again. Thanks for coming on, Stuart Moraine.
Thank you for having me on, Mr. Esmond.
Good. And I'll see you soon, mate.
Yeah. Cheers.
Take care.
Bye.